Hello and welcome along to the RT Rugby Podcast. Week one of the Investec Champions Cup is in the books. Week two is on the horizon coming up in the next few days. We have a lot to talk about this week. Some big wins, one very disappointing defeat for an Irish province in Europe, and some big games this week. First thing though, I want to talk to you about a Netflix recommendation, fellas. I didn't bring this up on our chat beforehand, but this came onto my horizon late last night. Right? I don't know. Did you see this at all in the last 24 hours?
What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Rugged Rugby, Conquer or Die.
No, I haven't heard of it.
Is a new show on Netflix. I saw people tweeting about it late last night. I've watched the first kind of 10 minutes of it. It's a Korean reality TV show where there's like seven rugby teams and they compete in like a series of like mini skills games across the sport. The reason I got sucked in because the first clip I saw was basically of just like an eight on eight like scrum match where basically it was like teams trying to drive each other over a particular line. These, 16 Korean lads doing it. I mean, just completely sucked me in. The way it's sold on Internet Movie Database is an intense survival reality show pitting elite rugby players against each other and the elements in a grueling competition to crown the ultimate athlete. I am in. I've only had time to watch. I clicked into it very late last night before going to bed. I saw the first episode was like an hour and 15 minutes long. There's like four episodes up already. So I've only watched the first 10 minutes of it. But it seems absolutely mental and very, very quirky in a way that Asian reality TV shows seem to be. But I don't know. I just think, like, talk about something different. Like,
The best thing about you finding this is the fact that somehow in the next 12 months, Bert is going to find a way in to be creative director for something.
Well, I'm just thinking,
it's the only country in the world,
no.
From a rugby perspective, that Birch doesn't have a finger in a pie. So that's what that's going to be. The instead, so after South Africa, Stellenbosch next year, he'll then move on to Korea, and he'll be creative director for season 2.
I'm just thinking there, Neil. If the first episode was scrummaging, I hope it wasn't the referee from the Bristol game, Bruce.
Oh, we'll get to that. We'll get to that.
that would have killed the chances. That's fascinating. So, but where do they get these elite rugby players?
They're Korean rugby teams.
Okay.
So I think it's a mixture of like they are the seven teams, I believe, in the like actual main Korean league, and they decided to put them into a TV show. So I think
I'll definitely check it out. Yeah.
It's a mix of like semi-pro. Yeah, like high level college teams. I think one's like an army team or something like that.
Okay.
So I mean they're all built like brick outhouses. Like, they're big fellas. Like they're not J1 fellas. But Rugged Rugby, Conquer or Die. I really actually just want to kind of watch a bit more of this. But like,
so we'll have a short pod. We'll have a short pod so we can get back.
We will. That'll do a lot more to grow the game than some identikit documentary series on the Six Nations anyway, would be my thinking. Like anyway,
put that down as research for your job then as well.
So 100%. Yeah, I'm on it already. Jeez, the ideas are piling up. Before we get into it, actually, now that Johnny reminded us, Bernard, how was Stellenbosch? We read a big coaching seminar there last week. That's why people on the pod.
I was invited down to speak at a coaching seminar. My piece was on data, how data is the new oil, and basically how the amount and the quality of data that rugby coaches now have access to and can use to drive performance, and just trying to give, I suppose, younger coaches, probably coaches in private schools, universities, clubs in South Africa. Some of them are academy coaches, but give them an insight into that. For me, it was the opportunity to watch the likes of Dwayne Vermeulen, Felix Jones, Joey Mongola, who's the defense coach of the Sharks, to watch them present, and they're absolute experts in their craft. I mean, Felix just did something very simple around the catch, and catch focus, and but the way he broke it down, he had access to some players from the Parle Gymnasium private school. That'd be like they'd be the BlackRock of South African rugby, you know, just steeped in history. Multiple Springboks came through there, and so he was able to do demo sessions, and it was phenomenal. And just the place, like when you spend some time down there, and it was very short, but you can see, like, it's hard to believe that they actually had slipped off being a top three or four team in the world before Razzie went back, because the culture of rugby, the population, the history that's there in terms of the school game, the schools then going and get, I suppose, less well off kids the opportunity through scholarships to come into that program. They obviously the dream and connection to play for the box is and the power of that, it's incredible. So it was brilliant, and just too short. I should have stayed. In hindsight, the Cape Town Sevens were on Saturday, Sunday. I flew back Friday night, and apparently that's an unbelievable weekend as well. You could do a nice week. You could do a week where I'm thinking about next year, trying to, if any of coaches are keen to go down, to hook them up, that you could go down on, say, a Monday, spend a couple of days with the Stormers, who are very open, and then do your coaching conference for 2 days, 2.5 days, and then do the Cape Town Sevens. If someone can get 7 days off work or 7 days away from the family, I think from a learning point of view and also a fun point of view, it would be a great week to spend.
I'll run it by my bosses. They might see it as a good feature for me next season, you know?
Yeah, there you go.
Broaden my horizons. We'll move on to the Champions Cup. So, first round of games, 12 matches in the Champions Cup. The first match of the weekend, Bath-La Rochelle, was a cracker. But it was the only one-score game of the entire 12. Eight of them were decided by 15 or more points. And, you know, there were three or four that were decided by a lot more comfortable a margin than that. We know, Johnny, like, by the time we get down to the knockout stages in this competition, like, this is the best club competition around. It is absolutely brilliant when you're down to the knockout stages. But it's a few years in a row now. The pool stages, this new format, it's just not as competitive as it once was, because teams know that realistically they need two wins. Maybe they only need one in some cases, and they can probably sneak through to the round of 16.
Yeah, I think there's also a player welfare kind of thing, and also a budget perspective in terms of what teams can actually really fight on two fronts deep into competitions. And, you know, there's maybe probably only three or four or five of those at the moment that really can. And I suppose, as you say, the coaches can be really calculated. Like, you take Michael Checa, for instance, in the team that he picked, and for Leicester, you know, he openly said, okay, we got 1 point. My target was 2 points. You know, so they're not necessarily, in his own mind, he's not picking a side. Obviously, you know, they're going out to win and stuff, but their ultimate goal is try and get 2 points away from home, come back, get a home win, and then they have a chance then, if they're on 6 or 7 points, that, you know, with other bonus points, that they have a chance of getting out. So it just lends itself then to, you're accepting the fate then of where the draw lands, and you're not going to be at home for those latter stages. But yeah, it is something that when they went into this format, that, you know, coaches are kind of being a bit calculated in terms of who they're selecting, how they're managing players, their minutes, where previously that wasn't ever the case. You know, Europe was the 2 weeks that you were, 2 or 3 weeks that you were fully on, locked and loaded. And that is a bit of a kind of frustration of this format. You know, I think obviously the Christmas back-to-back were something that everyone really looked forward to, because it was only half time after one game. So yeah, it is probably one of the downfalls of the competition, particularly the group stages. But then, as you say, we are probably waiting to the knockout stages for it really hops up.
And, like, Johnny mentioned Leicester there, how they were, you know, ultimately they went to Bordeaux looking for 2 points and they got one. I feel like Ulster are probably a similar example to that as well. And it's probably a good point to jump in there, because they lost 61-21 to Toulouse, the most they've ever conceded in a European game. It's not a record defeat, but it's the most they've ever conceded in a European game. And it was clear from the first whistle that it was Ulster weren't necessarily playing against Toulouse on Sunday. They were almost playing a game within the game, and that aim was to score four tries.
Yeah, and I think you're seeing that more. And I think if we have to be honest here, if you have a go at French teams, you know, coming over, or do you remember a couple of years ago Gloucester came to the RDS with a second string, and we kind of were very dismissive of them. We're often dismissive of French teams for turning their teams and not putting in a shift. Like, I think we have to be critical of Ulster in terms of the fact that when they picked that team, you know, they were effectively giving up the chance of winning. Now, you could have sent the first team to lose, and it was unlikely they would have won. But they obviously hoped they would get a point, and probably the game being so open increased their chances of getting a point, because Toulouse were so focused on scoring tries, and they were free rolling that they conceded obviously three in the end. But I also understand Richie's problem is that he needs to target games, and they're on the back of two defeats in a row in the URC. They're in incredibly difficult set of fixtures, Toulouse and Bordeaux back to back, and he wants to be able to come out of this in over Christmas and get some results in the URC. So, and I think the issue from an Irish point of view, and probably the French aren't going to change their approach. Like, only probably three or four top 14 clubs really believe they can win this. But it was interesting, the narrative from France was the Champions Cup now is the top 14 with Leinster invited. You know, that's who they see it. They see the winner being a top 14 club and potentially Leinster, which I think, like, Bath and Sarries potentially would have an argument. Munster maybe have an argument with that. But Glasgow certainly would have an argument, and a valid argument, I think. But it's an effect of the fact that Ulster now don't have enough international players, you know, current internationals to be able to focus on realistically, I think, beating Toulouse away or being more competitive. And you know, they have Cormac Izuchukwu, obviously he's a new international. They had Ian Henderson on the bench. But realistically, I'm saying, in the old days, Ulster would have had five or six, you know, players who could have been in the Ireland 23 for a Six Nations game. Munster, less so, but still, I haven't got as many internationals as did in the past, and you're just seeing that. You're seeing that, and squads are weaker than they were before. There's not as many foreign players in those Irish squads to be able to give you that consistency week in, week out, because they're not playing Test rugby. And it's a bit sad. It's sad. This competition needs, it won't be this week, but it definitely needs a good knockout stage, a knockout section again, because I think the group stages are going to be very up and down, very up and down, and frustrating, really. And you can see that with crowds, like in Thomond Park on Saturday night, like for a European night, the crowd was pretty poor. They tried to get behind the team, absolutely, but in terms of numbers, in terms of revenue, tickets sold, it wasn't where it needed to be, and it needs to be, or where it was in the past. So competition's in a tricky place, I think.
Yeah. It certainly is. And like, it's hard to figure out what the solution is, Johnny, because with the way the calendar is shaping up, they don't have that one extra week they used to previously have, where they could have your six round of games in the pool stages, and just also as well the availability of weekends before the Six Nations, where if they were to run off the traditional kind of pool stages as well, that would be leading in beyond the Six Nations, and I suppose that's very inconvenient for teams then just making things like travel arrangements for the latter stages of the competition. It is hard to figure out what the solution is that can kind of keep everyone happy, because there's probably a very neat solution where you could trim down the size of this competition, but obviously that means there's probably going to be less TV money coming in, there's going to be less, you know, revenue for the tournament as a whole, because there's going to be less matches on. So it's very hard to figure out what the solution is that appeals to everyone.
Yeah, and I think, look, it's a wider issue in terms of the, you know, people talk about a global season and trying to manage all of that together. And I think until all the stakeholders, you know, even the rights providers, you know, there's a, you know, how many different rights providers do we have across, across international rugby, club rugby, then obviously, the domestic competitions. So it's obviously, and then, so there's a wider conversation around all of that, that I think needs to happen, but there's a, you need to get a few people into a room to kind of knock out a solution for it all that, even in terms of international windows and having those opportunities. And then there's a huge amount of travel issues associated even with the URC and the knockout stages of that, and then into the travel issues that South Africans have here at the moment. All of that needs to be, needs to be spoken about. But, until you get all the stakeholders in a room and have that proper conversation around, include rights, and have a proper designated, probably an international or worldwide season, I think you're going to have issues like this, continue for the short and medium term.
And then you have the argument, like the less is more argument on top of it then as well, where, like, in theory, if you were to make the competition shorter or even to make rugby seasons shorter, does the product become better? And are more people interested in it as a result? And is that, could that actually potentially drive up a TV audience? Like, the greatest example that's ever used is the NFL, where it's a set, 18-week regular season plus a few weeks of playoffs. It runs from September through to the Super Bowl at the start of February. That is a pretty short season, and that is about as big a league as there is, sports league as there is in the world.
Yeah, and I think that, there is definitely, worth having a conversation around that. Like, people want to go see frontline players, and that's no, I might not have played so many games if the season wasn't so long or there wasn't so many opportunities for kind of those squad players. But at the same time, there has to be a player welfare thing around how many games are those, are those frontline internationals, or how many games are club players going to play? But there does need to be a conversation around that, I think, and it needs to happen sooner rather than later, so that we can sort out these competition and these logistical issues and have a top tier, international club competition that is the best in the world. Because when you get to the knockout stages, it is. But at the moment, it's kind of lost a bit of that in the group stages, as we've said already. And I think, we need to get that grow back for the pool stages, and have a bit more jeopardy on the pool stages, so that, you're not trying to calculate how many points you get here away from home or that, or what you need out of it. That it's very much a kind of winning your bust. And if you don't win, if you don't win a minimum of in the group stages, if you didn't win kind of three games, you weren't going to get out. Sometimes you needed to win five games to get out. And I think that's something that we need to try and look to get back to.
Yeah, ultimately jeopardy is what makes it. Bernard, are you still with us? Your camera's knocked off, but I just want to double check you're still here.
Yeah, still here.
Good stuff. Yeah. To bring it back around to Ulster, as you said, like, the rested players, Ian Henderson, Tom O'Toole, Rob Herring, Nick Timoney, Cormac Izuchukwu, were all on the bench at the weekend. And to be honest, not many of them played an enormous amount of minutes for Ireland in the Autumn Nations series as well. So you'd expect they're coming back in this weekend. They're playing Bordeaux. Ultimately, from Richie Murphy's point of view, if they come away from this game against Bordeaux in Belfast on Saturday afternoon with a win, well, he was justified in doing what they did last week, ultimately, yeah?
Yeah, 100%. And look, I've been there as a coach myself, where in France, you'd send a second string or an espoir team away from home on a Saturday, you'd take 50 points. And the pressure it built the following weekend to get a result was massive, and but then you more experienced players coming in, they're fresh, they're not damaged by they haven't been damaged by the poor performance or the beating, and you can kind of frame that in a positive way. It's not something we're used to in Ireland, but as I said, I think this year with Richie He has to box clever, and effectively it won't be till the last day of the season when you see where they are in the URC that you'll be able to make a call about whether he was right or wrong. He certainly felt that that was a decision. He after the match he was critical of how they performed, etc. But I think if they get another try there, they're actually pretty happy to have achieved their goal, because they have managed to mine some of their key players and get 1 point. Bordeaux are an interesting team to play, because they can be quite loose themselves. You know what I mean? They're obviously super talented, but like they were in a hole against a second string Leicester team. Now Leicester, the difference with Leicester is that Leicester had a scrum. I thought James Cronin was
He was
exceptional.
immense.
He
He was
was immense,
unbelievable.
and they were very, very well drilled up front. So even their second string team were able to go after Bordeaux in certain areas. And you know, it was really only a kind of Bordeaux were just asleep really for the first half, and the second half then they scored tries, which only they could score. So that's the challenge for Ulster. The opportunity is there in that Bordeaux tend to be quite inconsistent during games. But the challenge is when they're on, you know, not leaking points, because their X factor, their power, their creativity is phenomenal. Djaliber, they've announced that Djaliber is not coming. He's not traveling
Oh,
from
did they?
Belfast. Yeah, I don't know why. I think he's had a tough time. He spoke about his, you know, how tough it was for him, you know, at international level, and he lost a bit of confidence. So I think they're just conscious of minding him and getting him back right. So they've got given him the weekend off, which is a boost to Munster and to Ulster, and maybe they'll rest a few more. You know, Bia Barry was quite busy during November. Obviously, it's not the same rules around playing minutes being monitored by France, but yeah, it'll be interesting if they come with a slightly weaker team. And that would be huge for Ulster, because their starting team is phenomenal.
Yeah, and it was mad, Johnny. Like, just they are a fairly bizarre team. Like that game against Leicester on Saturday at halftime, it was what 21-14 to Leicester, who were good value for their 21-14 as well. And I'm sitting there at halftime thinking, geez, Ulster will properly fancy themselves next week, bringing this lot over to Belfast. And 11 minutes later, Bordeaux were about 14 points ahead. They'd scored three tries in the space of 10 minutes straight after halftime, and you're going, oh, I think I got
Yeah,
that one wrong.
it's how they punish mistakes at knock-ons, and their back three are so quick that a loose ball or a hack through that it's so difficult for teams to scramble well against them in if it's open scramble, and yeah, they just really do punish mistakes in terms of knock-ons, quick on the ball, shift, and then they've got so much, as I said, so much pace out wide that two passes in those positions, and it's like if you're in shape and there's forwards on the edges in your attack shape, then all of a sudden you've got a back three player running out of forward in a 15 with 15 meter space. It's like, uh-oh, they're electric on that transition, and yeah, they are a bit loose, as Bert said. And I think in those moments that they can be kind of off pace, Ulster need to try and make sure that they keep their foot on their throat there when they are on top, and that they make those 10, 15 minute lapses in concentration really pay for them. But they have to be really accurate, and bouncing ball on a 4G can be a bit, in terms of if you're not accurate, can be bread and butter to someone like Bordeaux.
Yeah, so that'll be Saturday afternoon, 3:15 p.m. Ulster against Bordeaux Beglers. Leinster then, Bernard, 35-12 winners against Bristol. This had all the makings of being an absolutely brilliant game of rugby. Just between the way the two teams play rugby and approach the game, it was 35-12 in the end for Leinster. Not a very good game, it has to be said. And as you have alluded to a little bit earlier on, not helped by some of the fussiest refereeing I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, he just lost the plot. Never laid down a clear marker. You know,
Particularly,
faffed around.
particularly around the scrum,
Yeah, the scrum was the
where
worst part.
it
Yeah, the scrum.
was
And look, he was probably a little bit
guesswork.
unlucky in that there were so many knock-ons There was a lot more. No, there's a lot more scrums, and that was the area that he just couldn't get any consistency with. And look, we saw late in the game when it settled down a little bit. When the two props were sin-binned off a steady static scrum, Leinster, scored that Sam Prendergast try. And I think Bristol likewise would have been really interesting off that platform of a scrum. But scrummager Rabah is a messy scrummager. Jack Boyle was new to Champions Cup rugby. There was a lot of issues with binds and weight pre-engagement, and you just had two front rows who just never settled. Never settled, and that was that's the big failing from him is that I suppose he waited that long to and lost the plot himself, or sorry, got frustrated himself and ended up Sinbin and Andrew Porter who just came on. And affected the game on paper. That was the most attractive game. Sorry, one of the most anticipated games, I think, of the weekend, and it ended up being a non-event, really. In terms of pleasing on the eye, from a Leinster point of view, they'll love the fact that they had to battle and end up with a bonus point without probably only playing for 20 minutes. But I think what they did do before that was they showed how good defensively they are, and I'm doing a piece pre-match 40 in Claremont about Leinster defence, and like people talk about the blitz defence, the blitz defence of Jack Nienaber, but and that obviously they're incredibly aggressive and it is a blitz defence, but how they barge at defensive rooks and the effect that's having, like even when the likes of Jordan Larmour and Sam Prendergast are doing it well when they get the opportunity. It's 15 man. It's 50 man. Is that when you're that plus one, can you slow down the ball? And what happened at the weekend was they obviously got a couple of turnovers, but effectively at the moment that Randall, the nine, is picking that ball, there's a body coming back on top of him. And then he's having to back two steps before he passes the ball. And by that stage, Leinster, who are already incredibly aggressive, are further in the face of Bristol. So I thought Leinster's defense and then the big hits, obviously, they have the athletes who can make big hits. So it's the barge, the blitz, and the big hits, the three Bs. And then I suppose the naivety of the other B, Bristol. Like, I know you want to play how you play, but have some respect for what's in front of you. You know what I mean? Like, they're not the first team this season who have said, right, we can beat this, we can beat this, and have ended up losing all kinds of morale and energy around it. And particularly when AJ goes off, when AJ McGinty goes off, I thought their chances of breaking Leinster off anything that wasn't a midfield ruck was slim. And then if you did break Leinster, they just tripped you up anyway. So like they didn't think of that, but no. Leinster discipline is a bit of a concern. I think they're so aggressive at the breakdown that they're getting away with it at the moment, but there will come a match where a referee will try and stamp it out early, and it's their ability to adapt and ease off on that. But they're very hard to break down at the moment. And I thought Bristol were punch drunk from trying to attack, and then at the end, that's why they concede the scores they concede at the end. But yeah, it's something I think Leinster will be frustrated that their attacking game doesn't look as fluid as it has in the past. But maybe this is a Champions Cup that they can win with a great defence and moments of magic from certain individuals rather than an all singing, all dancing attacking game.
Johnny, you were nodding along aggressively, I would say, when Bernard was making that initial point about defence. That's something obviously you've been impressed with too.
Yeah, it's their second efforts, and it's everyone, like, they're all in on that, and it's been coming for, it started last year, and there's it's so difficult to play against, when you're trying to play speed of ball off the line, when they're forcing you to have an extra man in the ruck to make it a bit cleaner for you, or whether there's just someone who's just, even though they're not competing for the actual ball, is just hammering the seal over it, and it's just so difficult. And they get those barges, they get past the ball, they get a couple of turnovers on that, and it just slows everything down. And for an attacking team like Bristol, you can, as Bert said, they were just so naive and like, oh, we'll just keep doing it and we'll double down on how we attack. But you can't do that. You have to try and attack different areas, different seams, and then it's how aggressive they are, and the number of passes they try and shut down from even from a midfield ruck or from an edge. But on the 15s, if you go back blind, they're trying to shut down one pass there, and it's just they're just relentless. And that bit is intriguing to watch. And when they get into the later rounds and they play the better teams, who have very much free-flowing attack like the Toulouses and potentially this weekend, how that continues to stand up against against those French teams that just like to play.
The other bit Birch mentioned then obviously is the discipline with Leinster. And while we were fairly critical of the refereeing when we started talking about this game, that was more from a stop start spectacle point of view with the match. So I think Leinster finished with 17 penalties, 3 yellow cards. They were probably lucky they didn't get one or even two more yellow cards, with Joe McCarthy avoiding a yellow for the trip, and even Sam Prendergast early on in the game probably. If that happened later on in the match, he might have been looking at a yellow card as well. And I would say a good chunk of those penalties were more than likely justified as well. So while we criticise the referee, that's more just from the stop-start spectacle slowing down of the game way. The discipline, when you consider the fact that so many of these Leinster players would have been involved with Ireland in the Autumn Nations series, and that was an issue going back there as well. Like, this is something. Both Andy Farrell, well, Simon Easterby now going into the Six Nations, but also Leo Cullen over this next while does have to kind of get a handle on.
Yeah, 100%. They'll give better teams opportunities to enter into their 10-meter 22 if it continues. And again, it's just being on that line, and at the for a lot of the thing, they're just over that line, and they have to have a bit more control in those areas. And it's like they're trying to be—they can be a bit too smart as well, and trying to potentially get away with things. But it's just not. There's little they need to a couple of things for me on the barge, which is excellent, but sometimes when it goes too far, they can swing their hips and get around. That's something that can be particularly the ref can see as quite frustrating, because if he's saying stop, it's one, but they continue to do it, that can frustrate him even though it's legal. But then it's when they swing their hips and they get lost in that contact. They just need to take, for me, it's just half a step back from the line, and they'll be on that, just on that line. You have to be very, very close to it, but at the moment, for me, they're just slightly over it, and it's just something that they have to be very mindful of, particularly as they move forward into the deeper rounds of this competition.
Bernard, Jordy Barrett looked pretty good for his 40 minutes. It was a nice little start. First of all, he sets up Sam Prendergast with a for a lovely little try, and then 2 minutes later, he gets in for one himself. The two of them in particular actually did seem to link up nicely during that second half.
Yeah, they did. Look, I think he's played with so many different combinations of players over his career that he's obviously very simple to play alongside. I think any of us who've played with New Zealand centres over the years, they all have an innate ability to communicate incredibly well. Like, they give so much information to the players either side of them. It sounds such a stupidly simple thing, but I certainly have had experience of playing and coaching pro players who are miles off what an NPC or Super Rugby New Zealand centre brings. It's one of the biggest differences, I think, in how kids are coached, or it's innate there. I don't know what like I've seen Kiwi coaches coach, but it seems to be just something that they do better than everybody else. But just on Jordy Barrett, I don't know if you saw this, but someone sent me something this morning. It was an old player profile from his father. So
I did see this, yeah.
his dad played for Buccaneers back in the day, Smiley Barrett, and he just did a spotlight on him. I don't know what year. It was 1988, but like your favorite coach, your favorite food, all this stuff. But rugby ambition. No, was it
Personal ambition, I think, or
personal
something like that.
ambition was to breed an All Black, and he bred three of them. You know what I mean? Like, it's just funny. It's funny how things come out. He was obviously taking the piss, and he bred three of the best All Blacks ever. But you're already looking at, if you can get a player like him for 6 months, it's phenomenal. Even up, I was up in Ravenhill. He was warming up. He was just warming up, and people are interested in him. I'm sure it'll be a couple of thousand extra on the gate this weekend to see him. But more importantly, from a rugby point of view, he's there as like a safety blanket. They had some injuries. Obviously, Osborne was out, James Lowe was out. Still didn't need to start him, but had him on the bench, and comes on there and has a big impact straight away. And those top end players, that's what they do. That's what they do. And likewise, just come back to Johnny's point, like, it'll only be an attack that's full of internationals that will exploit Leinster. Like, there was opportunities there to exploit Leinster, but just at the key moment, a Bristol player, his catch pass wasn't good enough. He didn't chop his feet to give himself time to get the pass away. He didn't see the space outside or didn't trust his skill set. But the international players, and speaking to Felix and Jacques Nienaber in the past, their defense can shut down 99% of teams, but the All Blacks, because of the skill set they had, always had a chance against it. They always had a chance against it. And unfortunately, when you look at what's ahead, the vast majority of teams won't have the skills to challenge that defense in a way. It may be just the time you get a real test, maybe against Toulouse at some stage, if they run into each other, or a Bordeaux. And you have to hope then on that day it works. But you don't get, unfortunately, it'll be comfortable most of the time because of the skill set of the opposition, if that makes sense. But the day you need it is the day you play a Toulouse side or potentially a Bordeaux. And there's no reason why it won't work, but it's just that's the real test of it.
Yeah, so that is Leinster beating Bristol last weekend. They're taking on Claremont on Saturday evening in their second pool game. Claremont 28-0 winners over Benetton, third in the top 14 at the moment. We'll move it on to Munster because we are already getting low on time. The big news of the week from a Munster point of view, and there's always news at Munster, it feels like every single week, but Mike Prendergast, Johnny, confirmed his name is in the hat for the top job of head coach next season. Not exactly surprising news. I think everyone suspected he probably was in there, but I suppose from his point of view and Munster's point of view, you may as well just have that information out there now rather than creating this vacuum of speculation and a sort of like you might see at the odd time with other coaches at other teams where there'd be this kind of half denial or this non-denial but non-confirmation either. Put the information out there. He's in for the job. Fly the kite. See what the reaction is like and see where it goes from there.
Yeah, well, look, people have said it from the start that, he was one of the front runners. If they and people said that, internally was where they needed to find. It's now down to whether, if they do give it to him, they probably, do they need to give it to him sooner rather than later now that this information is out there? Or then is it a case that he's in for it? He has to go through an interview process. If he doesn't get it, then does that add to disappointment, or do they bring in someone above him of as a director of rugby and then promote a director of rugby and then promote him to head coach, similar enough to how kind of Rassie and Axel were working, and then they have a bit of a reshuffle down whether he just looks after attack or do they bring in do they promote Mossy to be more more involved, which I think he is now anyway. So yeah, it's just there's a couple of things. For me, if they're flying that kite, I think they need to just bite the bullet and give it to him. I think he's a great candidate for it, if it suits what their model is, and then potentially look at maybe someone in that DOR space, that brings in, like even someone like Boyd, who they're in at the moment. but that fits what they need. But yeah, like if they're going to throw that up, I think for me, if it's going to be Prendy, just give him the job. He's a great candidate and he'll do a great job.
Yeah, he ticks pretty much all the boxes. I know he doesn't have head coach experience, Bernard, but that hasn't stopped a lot of the best. Someone has to step up to be head coach eventually, and he's had a very very long apprenticeship of jobs and assistant coach roles that have pretty much all gone quite well. Who beats him, really? It would have to be a pretty big name to come in and beat him to that job, I would suspect.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it'd have to be one of like the super coach, that are there's few and far between. What is there? There's Andy Farrell. There's Warren Gatland. There's Razzy Erasmus. There's a couple of the Kiwis. You could say Ian Foster. In terms of that big name that gets linked with pretty much every job, I don't think Munster are going to get those names, particularly at this stage in a World Cup cycle. I don't think they need it, to be fair. I think you mentioned there's a story out of Munster every week, but I think since the Graham Rowntree departure, it's actually been very well played by Munster from a PR point of view, from a providing I suppose confidence that everything's okay, that things are starting to settle. So whether that's Dennis and Mike re-signing, whether that's being able to bring in some props, whether that's the Chris Boyd announcement, whether that's Nick Winkelmann and the other IRFU staff who are apparently helping out, even Mike going up in press this week and kind of saying, yeah, my name's in the hat. It's kind of been managed in a pretty coherent way, which is great.
Yeah,
So yeah, I'd say it's
it's been a few weeks in a row of like generally positive news
yeah,
that
even
has just kind of
injury profile, the fact that Kilcoyne and stuff are there's positive updates about them. And results, the Lions a win and Stade Francais is a 5-point win. So yeah, I think it's definitely the crisis is eased there for sure. I would say Chris Boyd, if Mike got the job, if he wanted, would he like to have the access to have someone like him check in, on a regular or irregular basis, just to, could that be a combination or a package that eases Mike into it? I would say that the momentum and the hope is that he gets it. I think from players anyway, from players and staff. And I think, he hasn't got head coach experience, but he's been under a lot of good head coaches and been in good environments. And he's had a big role in rugby in Munster for the last 2 years. And there hasn't, I think. We've all seen that develop, a shift in playing style. Players like, Calvin Nash, Shane Daly developing massively, I think, under his watch. And even Tom Farrell, he's playing some of the best rugby of his career there. So and two halfbacks who have come from the pathway to be internationals. So yeah, I'd say there's a lot of momentum behind him. I don't think they will rush it. I think they'll stall it now, and Boyd will come in. I'm sorry, he's in, but he will get a sense check of where they need help and support, and probably he'll be involved maybe in the decision as well, I would imagine, around who becomes head coach. But I would say Mike is hot favourite at the moment.
So 33-7 win against Stade Francais on Saturday, Johnny. Like a pretty comfortable victory. Like they never really looked in any danger of losing it. Ironically enough, their weakest point in the game was after Stade had gone down to 13 players later on in the second half after two of the reddest red cards I think you're ever going to see. But looking ahead to this week, cast Friday night, Calvin Nash was up doing media yesterday, and first thing I said to him, this is going to be his first game against cast. Cast is a rite of passage for any Munster player, isn't it? Do you remember your cast experiences?
Yeah, I do. It's actually a positive one, actually.
Oh, the Ron Nogara drop goal game, was it?
That's right. The second week in a row. But I was one of the lucky ones. They actually moved the game to Toulouse Stadium that year, and they were given out that it should have never been moved. But yeah, it's a really, really tough place to go. evening rugby there, depending on the weather, it can, you know, it's tough. And it doesn't matter what they've done the week before. This is like a game that they are going to be massively, massively up for. It's one, it's a historic fixture. It's one for the fans and the French team. Like, it, this is the stereotypical home versus away kind of French team. Like, whatever they did last week doesn't matter. It's all on this week. And it's going to be very, very difficult. And they have a short turnaround, you know, 6 day turnaround to a Friday night fixture. But yeah, look, they have their 5 points in the bag. And if they can get a good win out there, even be it just that win, they're in a good, you know, a really, really good spot going into, you know, 9 points. That'd be a fair return for them. But yeah, it's going to be a, yeah, it's a very difficult place to go and win. It's never pretty. It's ugly, but you just have to try and grind it out whatever way. A 1 point win, it's 3-0 is all they need, and that's all they'll want.
Yeah, Bernard, like if Munster come home on Saturday with 4 points in the bag, regardless of what way they've done it, they are happy.
Yeah, 100%. I remember the year we won the European Cup of 2009, we lost in Caston in the group stage, having Hamilton the week before in that round 3-4 back to back. It's a very, very difficult place to go. And yeah, they don't love Europe, but they'd like winning at home in Europe. But I think Munster have a different type of game now, that they don't need to take cast on up front, you know, which is where the battle normally is up there. So I think they can definitely ask questions of them. And yeah, I think definitely get a losing bonus point and potentially a 4-try bonus. So they make them home with two, which would 7 points in the first two would be massive.
Yeah. And just final point on Munster then, actually, like you mentioned, obviously how they have a different game to maybe the last time they would have gone down to cast in January of 2022 or January 2022. But it, like, Craig Casey again on Saturday has like he is one of the informed players now this season. And he's just keeping the pace of that attack going. I just thought it was worth a mention because we mentioned him last week on the pod as someone coming out of the Autumn Nation series whose stock price has risen, and he seems to be continuing that on again now.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's brilliant to see. Obviously, they're becoming less and less reliant on Connor. Connor's getting less minutes. Craig is clearly
Connor. Connor Murray's injured at the moment, and it's, you know, it's not being seen as a big, enormous issue that, you know, is going to really, really hamper Munster. Obviously, it's a blow, bit of depth and all that, but Craig Casey has established himself as the man there now.
Yeah, no, sorry. I meant from the start of the season where, yeah, you know, Craig was number... I felt Craig was number one going into November, clearly. But then, obviously, for the All Blacks match, Andy decided to go with Connor. And I think Craig reacted really well to that in terms of what he did in green for Ireland after that, and obviously now going back to Munster, like the way they want to play, it's to try and, you know, break the game up. They know they don't have the power game, and that's the big obvious weakness for me is that when it comes to that arm wrestle, they maybe lack a little bit of sheer power, which tends to be important as you get to play the better teams. But what they are doing is they're stretching teams, they're playing fast, they're playing on counterattack, they're playing on turnover, and Craig's ability to get the ball to Witt at the right time. I mean, even his pass out to Daly was Gibson-esque, like, you know what I mean? But he doesn't get it there quickly, and the opportunity is gone. So must be really pleasing for him just to be at that level now every week. And I'd say he's becoming more and more comfortable in his stature in that team and how important he is to that team.
And speaking of other leaders then, Johnny, I mean, Peter O'Mahony, he just still has it, doesn't he?
Yeah, he was, you know, Albert's obviously done a piece on that kind of line out time. One thing Bert just said that he's probably going to take to heart, as you said, he doesn't have enough sprint. He doesn't have a great spring. His actual CMJ scores are off the charts when we're playing with them. So
I'm sure you know. I obviously don't, but it's not. It's that and the other stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's his intent. It's never like, you know, his pace and any kind of stuff you do on line out is all about the kind of quickness over the ground or anything that I would have done coaching wise, trying to, upskill yourself. It's all about his pace on the ground, your pace on your move, pace beats movement and all, and he just has that pace. And I think the biggest thing for, he's so ably assisted by his lifters, and he obviously has that connection with his lifters that they just trust his footwork and they go and then they throw him. And it really is. It's something that he's always been an incredible line-out operator, and his defensive stuff and his quickness on the ground and quickness into the air, particularly at that. In that two spot makes it very difficult for anyone. But yeah, he certainly he has it. And he said this is his last year, so he's going to try and go out on a biggest bang as he can in terms of a Munster shirt. And it was a great European start for him on Saturday.
Yeah, trust in the lifters, I think, is actually such an underrated skill or thing to wrap your head around, I would say, as a line out jumper. And I always think you see it with O'Mahony that there is no thought in his mind about what his lifters are doing when he is going up into the air. He is just thinking about getting that ball, and sometimes to a fault for his own body, because he's kind of recklessly putting himself up there and just putting all his faith in his lifters. And it's a big responsibility standing down there.
Yeah, just on that, I think you've seen Ireland over the last couple of years be more competitive at closing that gap and trying to affect the delivery if they don't win the ball. For someone who climbs kind of all over others, he actually doesn't give away many penalties for it. He's able to be very disruptive without, I suppose, getting on the wrong side of the referee as well, which is massive. But yeah, it was a very good performance for him. I mean, it's the best performance I've seen from him in red in quite a while, and even that's a great sign for the coaching staff and the fact that they're going to, like, I think Munster, obviously they've had another bad start to the season, but it's going to be a combination of the Caseys, the Crowdies, the Coombses, but also, the older guys, the Kilcoynes, the Archers, the Ryans. I thought John Ryan had a very good game. The Peter O'Mahonys, the Conor Murray when he comes back. They're going to need all that experience and legacy in the Munster jersey just to get him back to the top of the table again.
Before we finish up, Connacht in the Challenge Cup, 43-12 win against Zebre. They're taking on Perpignan on Sunday. Like we spoke about Ulster rotating teams around, Connacht have obviously done that in the Challenge Cup, but do feel it's probably it's apples and oranges to compare the two, because the Champions Cup is the elite competition, whereas your focus is going to be on the URC rather than the Challenge Cup. That's the reality of it, and maybe you start concentrating on it when you get towards the knockout stage. There was one bit on Connacht as well I do want to mention. Shane Bolton seeing a specialist over his foot injury that he picked up against the Bulls. And now they don't know how long it's going to be, but look, reading between the lines, if you're going to see a specialist, it's not a good thing necessarily. Johnny, like, that is just another blow for a player who almost every time he plays for Connacht impresses and has obviously caught the eye of the Ireland coaches, because he was called into the Emerging Ireland squad, which he also missed out with injury. It's just such an awful bit of luck for a really, really promising player.
Yeah, and look, he'll just have to kind of roll with the punches here and try and get back as best as possible and stay in it, and hopefully that luck does change when he gets another opportunity, because as I said, anytime he's played, he's shown someone that has a potentially quite a high ceiling. So hopefully he can get that resolved sooner rather than later, and get back on the pitch as quick as possible.
What did you think overall for Connacht to sum it up at the weekend, Bernard? Three tries for Che Mullins. There was a lot of rotation in there. They started off a little bit slow to get going in the game, but ultimately ran out comfortable winners. And I would say, given their record in France in the Challenge Cup, they'll fancy themselves of picking off another win this weekend against Perpignan, who'll probably have eyes on top 14.
Perpignan definitely will have eyes in top 14. I think this is why I was in favor of the Challenge Cup for Connacht. I just think when you compare them to Ulster, the challenge of managing, keeping the momentum, keeping the self-belief right, having shipped 60 against Toulouse, even though they rested some of the frontliners, it still would have taken a big effort from guys that he's going to need over, there wasn't a complete second string either. It was a weaker side, whereas Connacht were able to give some local guys from the pathway game time, get a big win, get that feel good factor. So yeah, it's the Challenge Cup is completely different than the Champions Cup, and we need to take that into account. But I think from Connacht's point of view, in terms of being able to come out of this block fresh and ready and confident, and having worked on a few areas of your game without having been risking too much, is ideal for them for Christmas. It should really. I always felt the Champions Cup probably cost Connacht about 8 points in the URC. So we'll see now if that proves to be the case or not.
Yeah, and they've two big interpros coming up over Christmas, Leinster and Ulster on the, I think, 22nd and 28th of December as well. That is where we leave it for the podcast. A reminder, you can see Leinster and Claremont of Erin in the Champions Cup on Saturday evening on RT2 and RT Player. Coverage underway from 4:45 p.m. And there's also live commentary on RT Radio 1 Saturday Sport. Bernard, Johnny, thanks a million as always. And we'll speak to you again soon.
Thank you.